Perhaps you'd have something to say about the idea of the blueprint.
Well, I am going to say exactly that,
Yeah.
because what is a blueprint? It's a map.
So the question I'm putting to each of you is this: was the Human Genome Project oversold? And is it time to abandon the idea that our genes are the blueprint for life? Stu, can I start with you?
Oh, you're coming to me first.
I am indeed.
I think it was oversold. I think its promise can be largely fulfilled, which is not the major view, I think, on the panel. The Genome Project was completed around 2003. Concepts and technologies that date back about 50 years before that bring us to the frontier where many, many of the dreams that we would have hoped for may be possible. I have to tell you about two inventions of mine. I apologize. But first, what's the molecular complexity of a cell? Your genome encodes about 23,000 proteins. Recently, we're discovering another 10,000 microproteins, less than 100 amino acids long, and about 50,000 long non-coding RNA sequences. So together, there's about 80 or 90,000 molecularly important sequences, and they interact maybe three at a time. So there's about a quarter of a million molecular interactions in cells. Each one of those is a potential drug target. That's a lot of targets. Next step, what's a cell type? In 1961, Jacob and Monod discovered one gene can make a protein that sits next to another gene and prevents it from making its RNA and protein. Remember, it's DNA makes RNA makes protein. 2 years later, they said, suppose there's two genes that shut one another off, A and B. You can have A on, B off, A off, B on. So cell types are different stable patterns of gene activity called attractors. At about that time, I invented what are called random Boolean nets with thousands of genes turning one another on and off. For the physicists in the room, it's quite astonishing. These systems have three regimes: ordered, critical, and chaotic. Critical is at the edge of chaos. We know 50 years later, cells are really at the edge of chaos. So we now know what a cell type is. It's an attractor or a stable pattern of gene expression. Cell differentiation is getting from one pattern to another. Hold that. Next invention also happened to be mine with my friend Marc Bonnivet 20 years later. The idea was to make random DNA sequences, billions of novel DNA sequences that are never before born proteins. So that technology has now been around for 40 years, and one can just make billions of random DNA, hence RNA, hence protein. We are just at the frontier of being able to expose cells to millions of proteins that can alter gene expression patterns and try to shift cell type 1 to cell type 2, which brings us to the next point. The genomic revolution hasn't paid off, in part because about 80% of the human genome proteome is not druggable. The reason is small molecule drugs need well-shaped pockets like locks and keys. Most of our proteins don't have well-shaped pockets, so they're not druggable by small molecules. But they're druggable by small peptides that can bind to disordered proteins. That opens up a vast array of new potential targets that we can hope for, and we can try to screen phenotypically for novel peptides that can bind to and interact with cells. And the basic idea is to do that, to transform sick cells into normal cells, like taking a cancer cell and making it normal in cancer differentiation therapy. I think it's at the edge of possible. In fact, years ago, I did it with a friend of mine. So it can work, but we don't know that it can work. This brings enormous power. It's going to mean one enormous further change. We may well have to be treating patients, not with a single drug, but with tens of drugs, with no combinations, and we don't know how to do that well. Let me put it together. I think there's real hope. It's just hope now. But if it's right, in the next couple of decades, we may realize much of the dream of the Genomic Project. That doesn't mean everything about you is due to your genes. I mean, it depends upon your environment and what you had for dinner. I think the hope is high.
Thanks. Joanna, then just to remind you of the question, was the Human Genome Project oversold? And is it time to abandon the idea that genes are the blueprint for life?
Okay, thank you. Really good to hear Stuart's contribution, which I feel I need to digest. Because I would say that in its own initial terms, the Human Genome Project has been a failure, at least on a medical front. And that's because it set off supposedly, that's how many people saw it anyway, with this idea that we would identify genes that coded for common medical disorders, and we'd then understand, and then we'd be able to make gene therapies to target them. So in 1996, a science journalist called Laurie Garrett, I think, wrote an article where she said, someone who comes into an A&E ward in a state of confusion and the doctors aren't quite sure what's wrong with them, by 2020, she said, they will have a little credit card in their pocket with their genome sequence written on it. The doctors will look at it, say, ah, that's what's wrong, and send them off for the gene therapy. She was a very well-respected journalist and had got that idea from some of the scientists running the Human Genome Project. But it wasn't just her. Robert Plomin, a well-known behavioral geneticist, was predicting in 2008 that in the next decade we'd have genes identifying, we'd have identified and be able to use genes for schizophrenia and depression and things like that. And we haven't got there, haven't got anywhere near that point, certainly for behavioral genetics or genetics of psychiatric disorders, but there are few examples even for common medical conditions. I mean, the few that we have identified the BRCA genes, for example, but not many other genes that have substantial effects for medical conditions. When I was preparing for this, I remembered that I had written an essay in the 1980s as a medical student on the genetics of schizophrenia. It was a prize competition, and I was very miffed that I didn't get a prize. And the prize was won by someone who, of course, wrote that, you know, of course, there were developments coming down the line that showed that even if we might not have the answer now, we would show that schizophrenia is a genetic disorder. The evidence, as I saw it at that time, which came from twin studies, adoption studies, family studies, showed that schizophrenia was a little bit heritable. You were more likely to get it if it was in your family, but actually the effect wasn't that strong. The figures that were always quoted were always the figures from the studies that showed the highest results. And as people have shown in lots of critical studies, those had generally been manipulated and didn't replicate in better conducted studies. So we were left with a situation that psychiatric disorders may be a bit heritable, but probably not much. And then came molecular genetics. And first of all, there were all these studies on candidate genes and lots of efforts to find them. And basically, they were a complete flop. None of the thousands and thousands of candidate genes that people thought might be likely originators of psychiatric disorders were tested and found not to have effects. Often an initial study would be published with positive results and everyone said, oh, look, you know, we found the gene for schizophrenia or depression. And then later studies would quietly come along, fail to replicate those findings. But often people were not informed. So the field sort of went on presenting itself as if it was making progress when arguably it wasn't. When the field finally gave up on trying to, well, it probably hasn't given up, but sort of pulled back from looking for single genes and candidate genes, it went back to this idea of trying to come up with a heritability score, of estimating heritability, which it did because it was discovering, as in many areas, that there were many genes with very, very small effects in, say, depression or schizophrenia, but none that had any sort of substantial effects. But if you added up all the genes with small effects, you could say that, you know, schizophrenia might be about 2.8% heritable, I think, is a quote from a recent meta-analysis. So it seems to me that leads us back to where we were at the beginning, really. And that all that is saying is that we're all different. Part of that difference comes from our biological heritage. But actually, whether we end up having an episode of depression or schizophrenia is much more likely to be determined by our environment and our circumstances. In fact, you can show that divorce is as heritable as, say, depression. But we don't normally think that, you know, that it's useful to explain divorce in terms of our genes. And I would suggest it's the same for psychiatric conditions.
Thanks, Nora. So, Dennis, I'm thinking perhaps you'd have something especially to say about the idea of the blueprint.
Well, I am going to say exactly that.
Yeah.
Because what is a blueprint? It's a map. How did we, as cartographers, get a map of the Earth? We first had to discover where all the continents were, because Christopher Columbus went off there from Europe, going west, hoping to end up right back there in the east. And what did he do? He discovered a totally new continent. So first we had to do that kind of simple identification of what the big structures are on the Earth. And there is a sphere. It's terribly difficult to represent two-dimensionally a sphere, as we all know. Now, what I come to then is the following question. Not only has the health benefits been delivered, they haven't, I'll come to that in just a moment, but what is wrong with the way we've tried to map the human body? And I'm going to quote from an article that has just appeared in the Journal of Physiology. It reads, "The conclusion," this is quotation from University College London, your university, my alma mater, incidentally, but it's a quotation from a team of about a dozen people who took the polygenic scores. Those are the outcome of all the genomic sequencing that's been done so far, together with, within the National Health Service, the identification of what diseases people developed later. So what did they do? They subjected the polygenic risk scores to see how well they predict cardiovascular disease, cancer, and then possibly schizophrenia, you name it. They write, "Polygenic risk scores performed poorly in population screening, individual risk prediction, and population risk stratification." Sorry about the long names. That's all the ways in which you can play around with the polygenic scores. "Strong claims about the effect of polygenic risk scores on healthcare seem to be disproportionate to their performance." It's clear already. The test has already been done by that team at UCL. So the author of this article went on to write, "Genome-wide association studies alone can therefore be a very misleading guide to causation. Moreover, since most association scores, as you say, Joanna, are unexpectedly low, we can now understand why. Robustness in living organisms is widespread. It's been developed by evolution. Causation, which is what we need to understand in order to cure diseases, is massively concealed beneath it, which is precisely why association scores are far from being equivalent to causation." Now, I just finished with one little remark. I got a moment? Do. Okay. I'm going to refer to two great physiologists. One was William Harvey, who discovered the circulation of the blood. He made a marvelous prediction from that overall high-level analysis. He said there must be anastomoses. He predicted the existence of capillaries. From high-level mapping, he understood what was needed at the low level. The second, you'll be surprised by this, was Charles Darwin, A physiologist? Yes, he was one of the first members of the Physiological Society of the United Kingdom in 1876. And he worked with physiologists to work out what is going on. And he also made a prediction, which has turned out to be completely true. He wondered, how was it that, he didn't use the word, but the Lamarckian process of use and disuse being inherited down the generations, how could that be possible? He said, well, the body must be communicating to the germline. And he said, there must be small, tiny bits of information that come out of all cells and travel to the germline. He's absolutely right. We've identified them now. They are the extracellular vesicles. They contain the RNAs that control metabolism. They go straight to the germline and they're inherited down the generations. You see, what I'm arguing is very simple. High-level mapping leads to prediction of low-level needs. The other way round simply doesn't work. And the polygenic risk score analysis from UCL shows exactly that. Incidentally, I'm the author of the article. It's just appeared. Anybody who wants the reference or a PDF can email me easily.
Yes, please. I shall do that.
Let's begin then. By looking at the nature of the question that we're asking here. It's about human health and genetics. And, many of you will have seen Sam Altman recently make the claim that with the help of AI and tools like this, it is conceivable that within the next decade, all of human disease will be solved, will be cured. So I want to start by asking, what would that even mean? Can we ever hope to fully understand the causes of all human disease before we even think about curing them? What is the nature of human disease itself? And I mean, Dennis, I wonder if I might come to you.
I'm actually delighted at the question, can AI help?
I thought you might be.
Those who were at a talk around 2 hours ago will already know my answer. No! Why? Because they will have to go and study what is already published. What is already published is wrong!
To continue watching this video, click the link in the top left or in the description below.
With a free trial, you can enjoy the full talk and thousands more.
Thank you for being part of the conversation.